Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Welcome to the Deceptively Fast Podcast. I'm Seth Payne. I'm going to be joined by my teammate from the Houston Texans back in the day, Drew Hodgdon. We're going to go through this article in The Athletic by Ben Standig that interviewed 33 anonymous NFL agents, and I love anonymous quotes, as long as I can trust that they're valid quotes, and I do believe that these are valid quotes. Some really good insight into how agents feel about the league and a lot of developments in the league. Please subscribe to the podcast if you enjoy it. Give it a 5-star review. That's even better. Here we go. And here he is, Drew Hodgdon, my old teammate and current volunteer high school coach. What age group are you working with right now?
I mean, it's high school, so it's freshman through senior.
Yeah. Are you coaching offensive line?
I am coaching offensive line. Yeah, I'm like the offensive line pseudo assistant offensive coordinator, I guess.
Because do you have a hard time like coaching the basics?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
like it's hard to actually teach somebody how to get down in a 3-point stance for the first time.
Completely. Yeah, it's funny you say that. That sounds like you had the same issue, I guess, if you had done anything like that. But that's totally true.
It's like
the very, very fundamentals are way in my rear view mirror.
Yeah. So, but I always heard these stories about Peyton Manning and Eli Manning going back to their old college coach every year and really just starting back at the bare bones basics. But they're not learning. Maybe they are. Maybe they are relearning how to regrip the football and everything. Maybe that's what kept us back, Drew. Maybe we didn't go back and do the extreme basics.
Yeah, I think I had other issues, but yeah, that was the. It's funny though because you forget all the most basic drills. You know, the stuff where you just were loathing doing it every day. But I guess at some point you kind of have to go back and do it because you really never do any of that once you get into like the college level.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much time allowed out on the field. But anyway, the article that I had seen that piqued my interest this week was in The Athletic, where they did a 2-part series. They interviewed and put up anonymous quotes from 33 different NFL player agents. And I thought there were some really interesting responses that were maybe a little bit different or that were at least from a different perspective from a player or a fan. So let's just jump right in on these. I wanted to get your opinion on this. And they started right off with the big hitter, Jerry Jones. Well, this is in part 2 of the article. Jerry Jones, what's your sense of the Cowboys organization and management under Jerry Jones now that it's been 25 years since they won the Super Bowl? And I thought the agent that answered it with the most all-encompassing quote said, they're on a different plane when it comes to the business of football. They don't win big, but they don't have to. There will be 100,000 people at every game. They will still make money all day long. They just crush it. He's the best and worst owner at the same time. But when have you ever met a player that didn't want to play for Dallas? I've had players leave for other teams and then become miserable. That last part was the part that caught me by surprise a little bit. Because I guess I never got a sense of players all wanting to go play for Dallas. But maybe I don't know. Maybe that was just me and I didn't realize it. Because I don't think that level of scrutiny or that level of fanfare necessarily appeals to all guys as much as a select few.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like the first two thirds of that quote are spot on. And then the last one, he sort of lost me because that seems like self-selecting bias a little bit.
Yeah. There.
Like, you're an agent trying to get guys paid. And that's a franchise that historically tends to pay pretty well. So that's yeah, I'm sure all too. You guys want to go there and you're asking them. And the ones that don't want to go there aren't broadcasting that they don't want to play for a team that might end up paying them.
That's a really good point. Another guy, a couple of guys brought up the no state income tax, which is interesting because that never seems to make a difference in the marquee salaries or when guys want to be the highest paid player, what have you. They don't seem to factor in the state income tax. I always appreciated it as a player because I grew up in a state that's got ridiculously high state income tax in New York. But like, I can remember paying state income tax as a farmhand thinking this is bogus, bro. But I think that this is the thing with agents. I don't think that state income tax factors in as much because the agent is paying on his share. It doesn't matter. Like if his client gets $10 million a year in Texas or $10 million a year in New York State, the agent's 3% is just going to get taxed in whatever state he lives in. So he's not really advising. That's not in his. He's not necessarily got that at the top of his mind.
No, that always feels like just an extra talking point that gets thrown out by either an agent or by the media or by people at large who are thinking about their own career and lifestyle. Like, oh, if I'm working for Xerox for the next 20 years, I really got to think about where my state income tax is. I never met a player who actually thought about that in a meaningful way and it affected where they went. That's crazy. Yeah. It's like number 50 on the list of 50 things that you're thinking about because who's it appealing to? It's not the super wealthy guys because that's not going to drive it. And it's not the guys like in the middle or the bottom because they're much more concerned about where they end up. Can they really get a decent deal? They're not that. They're not in a position
That state income tax doesn't help or hurt you if you just don't make the team. So it's a moot point at that point. And that's the key is that regardless of what the bottom line number ends up being, the top line number is the measure of how much a team values you. So that's where if I'm trying to decide between two places and one place is just flat out giving me more top end money than the other place, and I don't care what it factors out to after the income tax is all diced out, it feels to me like the one place values me more. And then there's a little bit of ego to it too. Yeah. There was another quote in here where the agent basically said that Dallas might attract the wrong kind of player because of that marquee element. And I think what he was saying was that the guys that do care about that stuff tend to like the idea of being a football player more than they actually like playing football. So if you get enough of those guys on a team and it's hard to keep the right culture around.
Yeah. Which tracks. I mean, I think it does over time. I mean, it seems like those are the kinds of guys they get. The Redskins kind of seem that way too.
Yeah. And I was like, Zeke Elliott is almost, I mean, he didn't choose to go there, but it was almost the ideal spot and the absolute worst spot for him. You wonder if Zeke Elliott, if he had just gone to a place other than Dallas, if maybe he would have had at least just 50% of the public issues that he's had.
Or even not have the ability to withstand whatever kind of scrutiny that they would levy on him because they don't expect to have such character problematic guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I feel like a place like Dallas, maybe he can survive because they are used to that and they can withstand that and they don't mind. I feel like in other markets, sometimes they're not going to be as comfortable with it.
Oh, I remember, you know what? I remember a time when I wanted to go play for Dallas, and it was when I was a rookie, and Dave Thomas, who's a cornerback for the Jaguars, who's an awesome older guy, a veteran guy, his locker was next to mine. He's a defensive back. He's just huge defensive back. Like he's like 6'3". But he was telling me about when he was young in Dallas, how it's kind of tough on a younger player because there's so much off-field opportunity. And by that, he meant, like when you go out as a Dallas Cowboys player, you are the woman in the nightclub, basically. Mm-hmm. Like you are hunted by women the way men typically hunt women in the nightlife. And it just, He just said basically opportunities abound. And so as a young guy, I was like, well, that doesn't sound bad at all. But it's but all the while knowing that maybe that wasn't the best setting for me anyway. I think that would that can upend a lot of young dudes if you just it's a different environment in Dallas than it is anywhere else. It's like Texas high school football, except on a pro level.
Right. Yeah. And there's an expectation that you're going to carry yourself like you want the attention and that you're willing to show off, some amount of notoriety, which is not the case everywhere else.
Okay. The second question, do you think Jaguars head coach Urban Meyer will succeed, especially with full control over the team? And they gave the agents the option to say yes or no. The vote was pretty much split, with 17 saying yes, 15 saying no. Did they account for the 33rd vote? Apparently they didn't. So I don't know if that was a mail-in ballot or what. But 17 said yes, that he would succeed. Quote, playing with house money has Trevor Lawrence. The AFC South isn't great, and you added the number one pick. Define what success looks like, but I think he'll show some signs, but it's hard to see how he lasts for the long haul with the modern day players. So I guess even that's kind of a tepid endorsement there of wondering how he lasts for the long haul. I guess that if it does work, they're going to have to show more offensive ingenuity than I've seen so far in the preseason, like all the cool different things they supposedly are going to do with running backs and his whole offensive look. They've been extremely vanilla so far. And I wonder if that's just him being careful not to show too much or show his hand, especially when there's zero film on Urban Meyer in the NFL.
Yeah, or being just in year one and not really sure what he has and not feeling uber confident in what he can really do yet. I mean, it could be any number of things. It's funny because I just think that anybody who had a real definitive take on this is just full of shit. Because there's no way anyone can really know on this one, I don't think. I mean,
like as far as the offense or him succeeding.
I mean, this guy nailed it with his, how are we defining success? I mean, what does that mean? Does it mean that he doesn't get fired in 3 years? Does it just mean that they went go 500 the first couple of years?
Do you have a winning record? Do you win a couple AFC South titles or something?
Right.
Bill O'Brien won 4 AFC South titles. Was he a success? I don't know.
Yeah.
I would say, you know what? He never felt like a success in Houston. And partly it was because you never made it out of the divisional round of the playoffs.
Well, and he never capitalized on the clear talent that he had.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, that was really what it came down to. And so for him, how much talent do we think the Jaguars have? I think some people would say a lot for the division.
Yeah.
I mean, they should be able to do something. So it's kind of relative to that. The easy take is sort of where I lean, which is it just kind of feels like his shtick might not work.
And there's reports of that already. Pete Prisco had said that a few of the veteran players didn't like it. There's a whole lot of symmetry with what happened with Tom Coughlin, except Coughlin had experience in the NFL. He'd been with the Giants for their Super Bowl with Parcells and everything. But that first year and a half, it was almost mutiny in Jacksonville under Coughlin. And he had to learn to gradually loosen up and lighten up a little bit. That's the part, the control freak part, is the thing that's impossible to figure, because Urban Meyer knows that he's going to have to change a little bit and deal with guys differently. But how much of it is just ingrained in him and that he won't be able to? Because if you look at two coaches that came purely from college and either failed or succeeded wildly in the NFL, Nick Saban, Nick Saban had some NFL experience as an assistant coach, but he's a college coach, gets his first job as a head coach in the NFL, and he just flamed out, and he had all kinds of excuses, but he quit. He quit. He walked away. I mean, this worked out well for him, but he quit. Where Jimmy Johnson is the opposite. Jimmy Johnson had as much success as anybody's ever had as an NFL coach, basically. But I think the biggest difference was that even though Jimmy Johnson was super tough and drove his guys hard, he was not a control freak. He demanded that guys practice and play their asses off, but he didn't. I mean, to notorious degrees, he didn't really care what else they did in the locker room, off the field, or whatever. And that's why I don't know if I can see Urban Meyer bending enough to how he has to be.
Well, because Jimmy Johnson sort of ran that same style at the college level. I mean, it's sort of what it looked like. I mean, he didn't look like he was doing it at any different than college level.
University of Miami.
Yeah, it seemed like his mantra was talent reigns supreme. So that's how they do it.
But he did also have a way, a manner about him, his methodology with players and the way he treated players. I think a lot of people probably thought, well, that's not going to work in the NFL. You can't be that tough on NFL guys. And that was that was a slightly different era. That was still where there were a lot of coaches that were old school and had brutally physical practices all the time. So I don't think it was as much of a change for a lot of those guys. But he was, I mean, he's an interesting guy. He was just a master motivator. And I guess maybe it's that he has a real natural knack for people that probably allowed him to get away with being more of a hard ass than even Coughlin or Saban or Urban Meyer could, because I don't think any of those three guys have I mean, those guys famously don't necessarily have a knack for like the personal side of things, where Jimmy Johnson can temper a lot of his hard acidness with like just being a funny and a charismatic guy.
Oh yeah. Saban seems like a sociopath, and you know, other guys at least seem somewhat approachable. I guess I almost reject the premise of them being a control freak, because they're all control freaks.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no, like, they all are. Every single one of them is. It's just a varying degree of how they treat their players at the college level as though they are the end all be all. And at the NFL level, a lot of players just are not subscribing to the notion that they can't talk to a coach like he's just a guy. And that's just not really a thing that you see a lot at the college level with those guys. And it'll be interesting to see, because he's had so much success at the college level that it's going to reinforce whatever behavior he has. And it takes a special kind of guy to reject all the things that got them that kind of success at that level to do it again at a different level in a completely different way.
Because
all he's had is positive reinforcement.
And I know, and it might be really ugly for the Jaguars this year. And I guess that's the, you're not allowed to, you can't go out and recruit an incredible recruiting class in college football. Now he's had quick turnarounds with other people's recruits. It's just different. And I don't know. It's not going to be, I don't think he came in expecting or believing that he's going to win 14 games. But the question people had with him was, you know, what if he, even losing two games is a big deal for Urban Meyer. So if you have a good season in the NFL and you go, you know, 12-5, is he going to be able to handle that level of losing, where reportedly after preseason games, he's been walking around in a stupor, just angry and fuming after preseason losses.
Yeah. And he's going to string together multiple potentially losing seasons that are last 16 plus games. That's a lot.
Okay. Here's one that I'm going to have to give a disclosure on this one. Cause the question is, how do you feel about the NFLPA and its leadership? Listeners to this podcast know that I've had Eric Winston, the former players president of the NFLPA, on. Drew, you're good friends with Eric Winston. The new president, J.C. Tretter, is a Cornell football alum. So we've got all kinds of conflicts of interest. So I say that as I read maybe the quote that probably summed it all up. The worst player agent, what are they saying? Oh, Players Association. The worst players association in all of sports. They do not look out for the players. The people at the top are not competent in their jobs. No comparison to some of the other leagues. Different stratosphere. Unquote. Now, the people at the top could be Demoris Smith and some of the other, I guess, civilians, we'll call them, not necessarily the players. Or it could also include the executive council and the players association presidents themselves. I'll say I think just from talking to various union reps and Eric and other people through the years, I think that the NFLPA is a different beast for a lot of reasons. And maybe the simplest one is that it's just massive. There's just so many more players in the NFLPA, and it's a sport that has a very, very high injury rate. And those are the two variables that kind of make it different than everything else.
Yeah. And the number of games.
Yeah.
I mean, each franchise really only has eight to 10 home games max a year to lean on as what's generating the revenue. I mean, those are all true. And it can also be true that, you know, we have a great relationship with guys involved and everything else, but that it's a problem that persisted long before they got there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been an issue going back way before when you and I were playing, when Gene Upshaw was involved. And
yeah, that's all. Yeah, like, a lot of people had issues with Gene Upshaw. Yeah. It's and that's why I've tried to figure it out, because I think it's true that I hear some of the baseball people, man, when they talk, there is just zero cooperation between the league and the players, and the players just flat out don't care how bad they piss off the owners.
Right.
I don't know. I guess with the NFL, I think there's always been more of a, I think from the Players Association side, there's been more of a spirit of cooperation or being business partners. The problem with that is that you're dealing with 32 billionaires, all of whom, or many of whom, are just flat out sharks. The way you get to be and stay a billionaire,
right,
even if you're not the person that became the billionaire because you're second or third generation, you've learned how to stay a billionaire. And that comes from watching out for numero uno, you know, sometimes to an extreme degree.
Yeah. With decades of professional experience in negotiating in most cases, and an army of lawyers that they, you know, have in their back pocket, on top of the fact that they are largely, and I'm painting with a broad brush, but negotiating in bad faith. And the other side, on the player side, is his position themselves to be negotiating in good faith more often than not, and it does not work out well.
Yeah, I mean, the owners flat out stole from the players a few years ago. Like they lied about revenue that they were supposed to share with the players, and they just flat out said, "Nah, we're keeping this." So the players had to go to arbitration to get the money that was just plainly and obviously theirs.
Oh,
it was a certain segment it was a certain segment of the revenue stream.
Yeah, and imagine if that happens in one of the other leagues.
Yeah,
what's the response by the players?
Right,
Kidding me? It would not fly with the others. So,
this last CBA, the owners did a really smart and savvy thing, which was they threw out a whole bunch of benefits for the lower class players, the minimum players, like a whole lot of stuff that was very enticing for really the bottom, let's say the 55% base of the electorate. So there are enough guys at the bottom. Then there were guys at the top that just flat out wanted to get paid. And there you go. I think the one thing that I get annoyed with sometimes is when like players themselves don't quite understand it, and they'll start complaining about how the CBA didn't include guaranteed contracts. Basketball and baseball don't have that in their collective bargaining agreements, or at least they didn't. Maybe one of the recent ones they updated it. Like that's negotiated by the players, and it became precedent individually. So those contracts are for the most part, most of them ended up being guaranteed, but it's not something that's provided by the CBA. So I mean, like Kirk Cousins got a guaranteed contract by just flat out signing a guaranteed contract. Russell Wilson almost got one, or could have if he had insisted on it. And I think that over time that might happen more, but am I kind of a sucker to see the owner side of this and say that, look, man, there's so many injuries. Like it's a different sport. it's hard to fully guarantee a contract in a sport where everybody's injured all the time.
I guess it goes back. I mean, that's obviously a valid point. I also think that it's all relative to, you know, I mean, what are we debating? Are we debating that, you know, is the PA like a complete sham top to bottom? Or are we debating that, is it reasonable to expect that there's pushback on guaranteed contracts from the team perspective? I mean, my position is that the players are getting fleeced. They're not using the leverage they have. Whether it's fair or not to expect a guaranteed contract is completely irrelevant. That's kind of like the player's traditional perspective is.
I got you. You're right.
That's why we're getting hosed. I'm like, I don't really care whether it's fair or not is not the point. Do the players have the clout to push something like that? Yes.
You're exactly right. I'm doing the exact thing that I was just describing, which was. I think that's why we're suckers. I think it's because of the nature of the sport and the guys that succeed in football. There is a part of you, I think more so in football players, that where you're a team player and you're a little bit perhaps of a conformist. You respond to discipline, like all those things. And that makes us absolute suckers.
You've been conditioned to always consider someone who even is perceived as an authority figure to be in charge of anything related to what you're a part of. And so someone walks in with a suit on, he might be a complete clown and have no idea what he's talking about, but your instinct is to just kind of roll with whatever he's suggesting. That's just how it is.
We're just compliant little.
Yeah, guys. You're compliant. You're totally compliant.
We're like those big elephants that can be held by a shoelace because they've been trained to be held by a shoelace. Like,
but it's not even unfair or unreasonable either, because what do you know? You don't know anything. I mean, yeah. you probably didn't spend a whole lot of time negotiating when you were in your college courses, you know? And so personally, I just mean all these guys who are coming out, it's like, what are they supposed to know?
Yeah. I would tell you how horrible a negotiator I am and give you stories, but I don't want any of our listeners to try to take advantage of me in the future.
Right.
How almost in every negotiation I get to a point where I'm like, oh, God, I'm so hungry. Come on. Can we just
get to lunch?
I'm like, this is really like, this is going a lot longer than I thought it would.
Right.
So speaking of which, how do you see the name, image, and likeness, the NIL permissions, factoring into your recruiting of draft prospects? Just in case anybody listening doesn't know what NIL is, this is the NCAA has now had to allow players by decree of the Supreme Court to profit off of their name, image, and likeness. Our institutions aren't allowed to pay NCAA players, but sponsors can. They can sell. They can get paid to tweet. They can do all these things. There's some rules and restrictions, but not nearly as many as people thought there would be. It's really the wild, wild west right now. This was the part. This was the part, Drew, that caught me by surprise. And it would sound almost like a conspiracy theory, but this guy says he's seen it multiple times. So these agents are breaking the rules. They're going to mom and pop stores in towns, like these college towns, presumably, and giving them money to give the kid a deal to sign them and then lock them up. So the agents aren't allowed to represent them as players, but they can represent them for name, image, and likeness. So now these agents are getting into the gig basically and saying, they'll go to, you know, Bob's Electronics Emporium and say, hey, listen, Bob, why don't you pay this kid, you know, $5,000 to do some autograph signings or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and just allow me, and then this agent represents that kid. And the kid, I'm guessing, doesn't even have a clue about it. He thinks he's actually just that marketable, and then bam, the agents are hooked up with them.
Yeah, this is the most underappreciated, most insane element of what's going on in sports. I think it's gonna be the next 3 to 5 years of this is just gonna be bizarre litigation. It's gonna be lots of new laws and regulations, I'm sure, coming to bear because of it. And then you're gonna go from, like you said, representing Bob's Electronics in whatever small college town to them during the commercial break, the quarterback for Alabama being on like a Geico commercial.
Yeah.
Like it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Plus Drew, I that's at the top end. What I worry about for some of these kids, and I'm not wringing my hands over this. It's just fascinating to watch because it's going to be so new to so many people. And there seems to be very little regulation of any of it, but I worry about some of these kids who are going to get a certain amount of money in endorsements, and they'll get a 1099 at the end of the year, but not realize or understand that they got to pay taxes on this stuff. It's different than, you know, it happens with NFL players, but you're already having your taxes withheld and you're making a lot of money. So some guys don't understand or get it with their endorsement money. But I mean, we get kids that are going to like getting
brought up on
tax evasion charges.
Yeah, you know? Completely. And it's going to happen. And that's how utterly pathetic the handling of it by the NCAA has been, where they completely are caught flat footed. It seems like they didn't somehow see any of this coming, even though they've had 50 years to prep for this moment. Completely weren't ready for it. And now there's no awareness. No, you think they're training any of these kids for those situations? Not at all.
Yeah. Like honestly, it's like France in World War II, where they realized like, oh, you know what? This is strategically, I think we actually just have to stand down here.
exactly. We are not ready.
Like to bag on France because France fought their asses off in World War I, you know, and it led to a whole lot of issues for them not being prepared for World War II. But so I'm not trying to like belittle the French people themselves or anything. But in World War II, they realized that, okay, resistance is futile. here you go.
And yeah, that's we're in a bad NCAA spot, did. It turns out. Yeah.
And because of that, they just opened the floodgates. They just allowed anything and everything to happen.
Exactly. The worst case scenario is what's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, the worst case scenario.
I don't know, though. We'll see. I think some guys.
Well, relative to.
There are very few actual huge names in college football anymore. It's not like it used to be, I think, because at least most guys are leaving pretty early after they have their huge good season or as soon as they can.
I don't know. I feel like the names are relative to the amount of branding and marketing that can be done on their likeness already.
Well, right? And so especially in college towns.
You're about to see a lot more names. Yes.
But especially in college towns, they are huge names because these are a lot of times small cities. Yeah. You know, like think of a college station. Austin's an exception. Think about some of the other places where big time college programs are. They're small cities that don't necessarily have the same equivalent as, okay, you know, Houston might have James Harden or whomever else, like a big business in Houston.
Exactly.
Can do that. These smaller cities don't have anybody like that. Now, all of a sudden they do. So that those guys will be in demand, especially for local stuff. A city of 100,000 or 500,000 can have like a mega superstar all of a sudden by their standards.
Yeah.
They weren't able to before. I'm thinking about myself. I had I met Brian Bosworth a couple weeks ago. I ended up going to a wrestling.
First time?
Yeah, that was my
first time. I figured you would have bumped into him a handful of times, just like on Radio Row or something.
I guess so. I don't know, but I was we went to an AEW wrestling event because we have we've got a mutual friend, this guy named Wallace Marsh, who's a huge Oklahoma booster, and that's how he knows Bosworth.
Okay.
So he brought Sean Pendergast and me and Brian Bosworth and then Wallace's son. We all went to this AEW wrestling event. But Bosworth knew Sting. They had done a movie together back in the day. And Sting, the wrestler, not Sting, the musician, Sting, the wrestler, was wrestling at this event. And it was really, really cool. But it's funny because Bosworth was the first guy I thought of when it came to what would NIL have been like back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, he would have been, I mean, think about Bosworth, a guy like Bosworth with social media. If he had that back in the 80s, he would have just been a monster. He was like a cross-cultural phenomenon. There were like just kids all over America had that haircut because they loved the Boz. And like he would have cleaned up. He would have made, and he would have known how to do it too. Like he had a flair for showmanship.
He was singular. There really have never even been that many that have had that kind of clout, I guess, in the media or anything else. Like even after that, I think of like the guys all through, I mean, Miami's a good example, but even like USC around really like when I was in college, when they had that string under Pete Carroll with Leinart, and they're in a market like LA with Leinart, Mike Williams, Reggie Bush, and those guys. I mean, I feel like they would have absolutely just been off the charts with any kind of endorsement or anything else.
I remember being really annoyed by USC just because was Benny Joppru good friends with Leinart? Were they buddies or something? Or did it just seem like maybe they would be?
We all kind of were in the same circle along with like Dave and everybody else from that area.
Dave Ragone, current quarterback. Yeah.
Or I was like an Anderson, but yeah.
Oh, okay. I just remember that, how annoying that argument. I just remember before the national championship game, all these pieces on ESPN talking about whether or not USC was the greatest football program ever, that 2-year stretch or what have you, before the game was even played. And that was the day I became a true Texan. I was these Californians, they ain't Yankees, they ain't Southerners. They're just
They're just way better than us at football.
That's right. You're a California high school guy. I saw that Matter Day. Is it Matter Day? Just beat up on some Texas high school football team. There's nothing more pathetic than interstate football smack talk on Twitter, but I saw a bunch of it.
Embarrassment of riches, I guess.
All right, real quick. If you were granted power over all things in and around the NFL, what's the one change you would make? Guaranteed contracts. I feel we've talked enough about guaranteed contracts. That got the most votes, especially you can imagine from agents, especially they're going to be voting for more guaranteed contracts. Eliminate the franchise tag. Is that possible or desirable?
Well, I mean, I don't understand like the vagaries of the franchise tag and how they affect like players directly versus what they could get otherwise and all that stuff. And then that ties to me, it all kind of trickles down from the contract issues, right? Yeah. So it's like, if you have guaranteed contracts, then does the franchise tag become a different thing entirely? And so it's kind of a, it's kind of difficult to understand that one for me personally.
Eliminate drug testing for marijuana. That got 3 votes. I thought it would be more, but then I remembered that the NFL has basically decriminalized marijuana, right, the equivalent of decriminalizing it. So now, from an agent's perspective, they're not going to have clients getting suspended nearly as easily for testing positive for marijuana. And it's already kind of hard to test. Like, you got to try to test positive for marijuana. It's
right. That's it's what really, I was going to say.
It's once a year and there's a threshold. The threshold isn't as high as it is in some other sports or even for the IOC. Unless maybe I missed that. They might have raised it in the last collective bargaining agreement, but it's not from what people have told me. And I'm not winking as I say this or anything. I wasn't a big pot smoker at all. But guys were never, I just never met any guys that were all that concerned about it.
Right. Yeah. I feel like maybe they, this, what they're saying with eliminating drug testing is more of like a cipher for allow all recreational drugs to be used. Kind of what I kind of feel like that's supposed to mean.
Just don't have, like, employers shouldn't be legislating this stuff for monitoring. Yeah, like, yeah. It doesn't have to be. Yeah.
It doesn't affect, like, if it's affecting your on-field performance, then you're not going to be playing. So
the unrestricted free agency after 3 years or an earlier negotiating window, that got 2 votes. I, like, honestly, I'm pretty laissez-faire when it comes to this. I feel like the most American thing and the most interesting thing, and maybe ultimately the best thing for competitive balance, would just be to open it up to free agency. Like, just, totally agree. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, screw the draft, just have a bidding period. And if teams overspend and they make bad decisions, then they'll pay the price for it down the line. And that probably, without thinking it through too thoroughly, I feel like that would negate a lot of the incentive to tank, because you're going to get the same amount of cap space, you know, as everybody else all the time. And it's up to you to do with what, if you manage it well and do make better decisions, you can vault yourself up.
Yeah. I could see how it would administratively just be like a complete nightmare. And maybe that's part of it. But beyond even just the, rookies coming into the league and how that's managed, I am generally just a proponent of just free agency being possible throughout the entire season, period.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I just think you should be able to trade and make moves without any kind of,
you know, Mike Meltzer, my old co-host, who you know well, because you actually hung out with him in Chicago for a little bit, right?
Scared him from
his eye. Yeah, let me tell you what his old take was, and then you can tell the story of scaring him. and then we've got a story about Paul Gallant, another one of my old co-hosts that you had to run
into.
Meltzer's take is that you should allow tampering. Open, like, just no rules on tampering, which at first I thought that was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard. But the more I thought about it, and especially now that I'm a wrestling fan, because I've been to one event and I'm kind of into it, I say, yeah, more drama, the better. Allow tampering, allow publicly proclaiming how much you'd love to sign this guy who's going to be a free agent. That would make things way more interesting.
Oh, it would. I feel like it's very much like a media person's take on it, right? Yeah. Like, the amount of stories generated
if teams
were just openly trying to court and woo different players, or the opposite. Like, yeah, we really just cannot stand this guy. We'd love to swap him out for 3 others. You know? That would be way more interesting. I can see how it just would be a total debacle for each individual team.
So Mike Meltzer is a very buttoned up guy. And awesome guy, but my old co-host, he's very buttoned up. That's the way I'd put him. You know, he's kind of rigid, and, you know, just like likes things a certain way. Not a big drinker at all.
No,
like, he's not opposed to drinking. He'll have a drink or two, but if he has more than 2 drinks, it's pretty exceptional. So that's how I'll set this up. He was up in Chicago and went out one night with you guys when he was up visiting.
Yeah, he came. I was out there with, I had another former teammate from ASU, and he played in the league for, you know, I think like 10 years or something. But Scott Peters, who I think you may have actually played against at some point, but, you know, great player, not necessarily known for his, oh gosh, his propriety just in general, right? Yeah. I mean, he's a brilliant guy, like super sharp, as all offensive linemen are, obviously. He was there, he was visiting. So we were going out, just kind of catching up. I hadn't seen the guy in a while, and Mike happened to be there too. So we all went out and kind of did the typical Chicago thing. And like you said, I mean, Mike is more of like a cerebral kind of sports analyst type. Yeah, I mean, that's like, he approaches all those things like as individual problems and all the angles, which is great. I don't know if he was used to actually going out with us in that way. And it would surprise me, because from co-hosting with you and being in this space, I thought he would have been more exposed to just like drunk Neanderthals just getting kind of
rowdy. Yeah. Yeah.
To some extent. Like, we were not, the way Mike describes it, I think he makes it seem like we were about to get in a fist fight.
Yeah.
In public, which yeah. was not, that was not the case.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very run of the mill kind of.
You,
like,
you guys were just arguing about something, right?
Yeah. We were just arguing and being obnoxious and huge.
Yeah. I know. I think the size has something to do with it. And maybe that, yeah, I don't think he's been around a lot of guys just acting like damn fools. Or yes, it's because I remember when the first couple times I went out with him, I think what he kept saying something like, "It's like I just don't know what would happen if you got out of control. Like, how would somebody control you?
Yeah, exactly.
I've made it this far without being arrested or anything. Like, I don't like
the wheels that I saw turning in his head were, if this plays out in a certain kind of way, no one can stop this.
Oh, no, yeah, that's
to stop this.
Like, who's gonna break up a fight, or who's gonna stop him?
What if I get roped into this somehow? Am I gonna be in danger? Like, it was funny.
You know what I bet there. It was? I bet it was him. Remember that? Do you remember that video of Richie Incognito with his shirt off in a bar in Florida?
Yeah,
he was like going around just freaking out. It looked like he'd just done a ton of coke or something, you know, was just like shaking his fist and saying, Mike, motherfucking Pouncey or something like that. He was out with the Pouncey brothers. When you watch something like that, that is the thought you have. Like, who's going to like tether this elephant down? How the hell are you going to stop somebody like that?
Well, you're going through like the actual logistics of it. Like, do we need a net? How do we slow this down?
But that's Richie Incognito, who's like literally a 1 in 10,000 offense for NFL players. Like, by all standards, he's one of a kind. I don't know if I've ever run across anybody like Richie Incognito in person.
Agreed.
So I think that was probably his worst case scenario. It was like, how would we actually stop this or control
things? When I heard that he was so flustered after, I was offended. Oh, I felt like personally a little like, who am I? You've known me. What did you think was going to happen?
I am.
Who do you think I am? I'm not just like this unhinged monster out there.
You know, there's something to that, Drew. Cause maybe it's a justified thought. Cause when I was in college, there was this thing called the Sphinx Head Society, which at Cornell is a service organization where they take a few kids from like different groups around campus as representatives. It's kind of supposed to be a secret organization, kind of. But they bring in, you're supposed to work on charitable good works, do charitable deeds around town and everything. And they do that now. Because they had to reform. Because back when I was inducted into it, it was kind of going through maybe a less philanthropic phase, and this century old organization had turned basically into a drinking club for a few guys from each sports team. So it was cool. It was a lot of fun because it was like once every couple of weeks or so, you would go and you would drink at the Sphinx Club, and it was just a couple guys from the junior class and a couple guys from the senior class from each of the male varsity sports teams. And then maybe another couple organizations, so there were a few lacrosse players. There were a few football players, a few soccer players, the ice hockey guys. I always felt like they should have had allowed in because they were so much fun. So it was really cool. But the night, and I didn't really know what was going on or what was happening. I'd never really heard about it or thought to ask what it was or anything. My junior year, the night I got inducted, they stormed into my room, like these, like six dudes, two of whom I knew, but six guys storm in and jump on me. And and one of them, somebody had gotten me word like a half hour before. They're like, "Seth, just go with it. All right, listen, something's about to happen. It's all cool. Don't worry about it. Just go with it." So I was like, all right. So I knew something was going on, and it felt like, okay, this is some kind of an induction or something.
Right.
But I was like, but I feel like I should put up a fight. I don't want to look like a punk. So like,
I'm not going to sell out completely. You wouldn't want me in this club if I just caved instantly.
Right, exactly. So one of the kids, Pat Cullen, told me afterwards, he was like, we ran in there and we jumped on top of you. And you stood up with all of us on you. And I was thinking, like, what the hell are we going to do?
What happens now, guys? This is uncharted territory.
You jumped on me. I was on the ground. I had six guys. And I just stood up like a giant, you know, with people draped all over me. And then I kind of just was like, oh, no. Oh, dear. Gosh.
Where it's like a tranquilized bear.
They put a bag over your head and everything. They take you out.
Definitely couldn't shed you like so many deadly. If I needed to.
But that's what he was thinking, like, man, if he decides to really start fighting.
Right.
I think that's the thing. If you're a giant getting attacked by six normal sized people, you really only have to beat up a couple of them to scare off enough of the other ones. You want to be really, really violent with the first one.
Like, that's exactly right.
You want to hurt him bad. You want to get medieval on his ass to try to put some doubt into the other people's minds.
Correct. You want to make a real statement in that first few seconds.
You want to take out some hunks of flesh. Right. All right. Well, we'll save the Paul Gallant story for another time, because Gallant, for people who listen to the radio show here in Houston, know Paul Gallant, but people on the podcast have heard him too. So, all right, buddy. Gallant, but people on the podcast have heard him too. So, all right, buddy. Yeah, enjoy your weekend of football. And yeah, we'll circle back here in a few days. You can tell the Paul Gallant story.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!